Este podcast é patrocinado por Solverde.pt, casino online e apostas desportivas. São muitos anos.
Olá, sejam bem-vindos. Este é um podcast muito especial. Não é nem o Fórmula 1 na Sport TV, nem o Grelha de Partida. É um especial com David Coulthard. O ex-piloto de Fórmula 1 aceitou o nosso convite para falarmos exatamente disso, de Fórmula 1, também um bocadinho da carreira dele, não só na Fórmula 1. E a partir de agora este podcast será em inglês. David, thank you very much for being here. And I'm going to start. We're going to start in a way which is different. We're going to have our play-by-play commentator here in Sport TV. He has something special to show you.
Hello, Mr. Coulthard. I'm really, really, really sorry I can't be with you in this very particular meeting, but I trust you are in the good hands of our very talented F1 pundits. Now, I didn't want to waste the opportunity to show you a picture that I have kept secret for about 20 years or so. So please take a look at this. This is called Special Delivery David Coulthard on the trunk of a Mercedes-Benz SLR. It was in Paul Ricard. I got to do a couple of laps around the track with you at the wheel. I remember asking you then, how did you feel racing around such talented and gifted guys like Michael Schumacher, Mika Hakkinen, Fernando Alonso, and so on? Your answer was, it's such a privilege, you cannot imagine. I still can't imagine, David. Maybe this is a good topic to begin your particular conversation with, so sorry I can't be with you, but I will watch this very closely. Thank you for being with us.
David, a very special photo. I don't think you remember the photo.
No recollection at all. I've got no idea what I was doing there other than proving that you could smuggle a person in the back of an SLR Mercedes.
But the question is the same. It was a privilege to drive with that amount of fantastic drivers.
Absolutely. I've lived an incredible life through motor racing. I take myself back as a young boy watching Formula One on television, you know, in the UK at that time. We had a sports commentator called Murray Walker, who was the voice of, of British TV, very knowledgeable and very unique voice. And alongside him was James Hunt, who we know was a world champion, and was it 76? I think he won the world title. So they were the link to this amazing world of Formula One, where I would see, you know, races all around the globe. So to have gone from being a fan watching it on television with my father to racing go-karts in Britain, to suddenly being in a Williams as a test driver through to becoming a Grand Prix driver, it all seemed a little bit surreal in many ways. But that said, I remember when I was 14, my father saying to me that, you know, son, when you get to Formula One, if you're lucky, you might have a 10-year career, so you should consider working in television like James Hunt after your career. And then 10 years later, I'm in Formula One, and 15 years later, I've signed already to work with the BBC before I'd finished my last season with Red Bull. So everything kind of played out the way we imagined as a family. But the journey continues. And like you, I work in broadcasting now. I really enjoy to, you know, go to the Grand Prix, to watch the young talent coming up, and to try and share with an audience that I always imagine it's a young boy or a young girl like me who's never been at a Grand Prix, dreaming that one day they can travel. So when I'm doing the commentary, I speak with that in mind rather than thinking I'm talking to the experts.
But when you talked about being the privilege of sharing the track with all those big guys, and especially have seen many great drivers before them, and now we can watch other great guys, as was, for example, Sebastian, and now Lewis and Max, and still Fernando.
Yeah, incredible.
Do you find any sense of when people take those discussions about who is the greatest driver of all time?
Well, it's always going to be the debate, isn't it? Who is the greatest driver?
Do and you I think, find that that makes sense, that debate?
Because no, in as much that you can never prove or disprove anyone's belief. You know, an older generation may believe that Fangio was the greatest ever because the era that he raced, the danger, and also his age. He was well into his 40s. I think maybe our generation would look at Senna, maybe a little bit before mm-hmm. him, maybe, you know, a little bit after. So the reality, I think, is, and I think it's the same in football, if you were to take Pelé at his peak or Ronaldo at his peak or whoever the era of players, they would be exceptional against each other because the generations mean that you'll never have the chance to put them up against each other. But to Formula One drivers or racing drivers at the highest level, whether it's sports cars, whether it's touring cars, the highest level, they're all very talented. They're all very good. But I think it's no different in motor racing, Formula One, as it is in other sports. You're looking for exceptional. And in Formula One, exceptional for me are the guys that are serial winners. They're the ones who win multiple championships. With the greatest respect to some drivers who've won one championship, you can get lucky in the right car in the right year and have a weak teammate and win a world championship. But if you do it twice, if you do it three times, if you do it seven times, like Hamilton and Schumacher, you're exceptional.
Do you feel that you miss that world title? That's something that you would like to have?
I never think about it. Really, I had great opportunities in Formula One. I started at Williams testing for Nigel Mansell. Then I tested for Alain Prost. Then I worked with Ayrton. Undoubtedly, an incredibly special driver and person who had a home in Portugal for his European season and was instrumental, not only obviously through the tragic death that happened in Imola along with Roland Ratzenberger, but he was really supportive to Frank Williams of how we interacted, how we worked together, and telling Frank that he believed that I had the potential to be a Grand Prix driver. And ultimately, I think that's why Williams decided to go with me when there was other more experienced drivers available at that time. So if I had won a world championship, would I be a better father? Would I be a better partner, a better son? Of course not. Would I be wealthier? Of course. Would I be more recognized? Probably. But does it actually fundamentally change who you are as a person? I never raced for acceptance. And therefore, I never raced for adulation. I raced because it was our family weekends and karting, and watching Grand Prix was something I loved to share with my father. And he believed more in my potential than I did. So that's when we had the conversation when I was a teenager that one day I would be in Formula One. He couldn't, you know, how could he ever know that was possible? But actually, if you set a target, you should never be surprised when you achieve it. It's when you have no target that it becomes difficult to know what direction or what path you're on.
That's why you accepted the challenge to race with Red Bull when the team was launched and was seen by other teams as some kind of a bit of a joke of people listening to loud music, and they were not taken very seriously by the other teams.
You're absolutely right, because ultimately when Red Bull joined Formula One, they had been a partner sponsor of Sauber, but an energy drinks company taking on Ferrari, taking on Mercedes, and you know all of these great teams. But what people underestimated was the vision of Mr. Mateschitz, and that vision built a drink sector, because prior to Red Bull, there wasn't really an energy drinks sector. So his vision built one of the most recognizable brands in the world. And he's always used sport as a way of marketing and engaging with the audience, because sport is for all. You know, football is a perfect example of that. You have the children, the grandchildren and the grandparents all celebrating their favorite team. So I saw in his commitment when I met with him that he fully understood the challenge. And of course it takes money. But if money was the only resource required, then Toyota should have won a world championship. They had more money than even Ferrari when they came, but for some reason decided to build their factory in Germany. You know, Germans are fantastic and the engineering's fantastic, but they have some of the stringent working rules in Europe. And therefore, to try and operate against, you know, Red Bull in the UK or McLaren or the teams where the work ethic is, we do the hours that are necessary. And people willingly work long into the night when they're, you know, preparing for the start of a season with a new car. So there were some strategic decisions that they made that was never going to work. And, you know, Mr. Marischitz is a proud Austrian. The team has entered under an Austrian flag, so therefore we have the Austrian national anthem being played. But it's very much a British-based team because Britain is the most successful source of Grand Prix victories and world championships through the history of time.
Why is that? Why is the, with the exception of Ferrari, why is the knowledge, the Formula One knowledge, all concentrated in England?
Well, I think historically, Formula One grew up out of enthusiastic RAF pilots and the likes racing around the airfield. You know, Silverstone was an airfield during the war. Mm-hmm. I think that as it's extended, you know, Ferrari are the exception, of course. You know, the vision that Enzo Ferrari had for Formula One is absolutely clear. But I think that if you look at Britain as a place to live, a place to educate, a lot of the engineers internationally would come through universities in the UK. Families would want their children to be educated there. And I think it just over time, it becomes a sort of self-perpetuating situation where the suppliers are there, the mechanics are there, the engineers. You know, Formula One is a truly global sport. So the teams in the UK have Portuguese, French, Italian, you know, British, American, whatever, every nationality you can imagine. But I think in many ways, it's easier for these engineers when they have family to have their family base in the UK just because of the, you know, the schools and things like that.
So you can say it's a global sport, but it has to be based in Britain.
Well, it is a global sport where the foundations largely are based in Britain. But of course, the exception is Ferrari, or, you know, yeah. I think it's only three teams that are outside of the UK with Sauber mm-hmm. or Alfa Romeo or whatever they're called nowadays, uh-huh. You know, Toro Rosso and Ferrari. But it's only Ferrari that seem to have the draw and allure to bring, you know, the right group of engineers together.
And even there was a time that Ferrari had a part of it in England.
Yeah, that's like John Barnard. He had his design office there. Yeah. So there's no getting away from the influence of the UK. And I'm not saying that as a British passport holder, because
it's a fact.
It's just a fact.
15 years in Formula One. The last 15 years, it's outside Formula One, being in Formula One. When you do a Red Bull show run, you still go into the car with the same adrenaline, with the same sensation, the same desire?
Well, the risk is obviously something I have to manage because it's a public event and there's a responsibility. So, of course, I have a focus that I want to entertain the people that have given their time to come along. There's not the same, let's say, nervousness.
But the pleasure.
The pleasure, of course, because to jump in a Grand Prix car is still a privilege. You know, the V8 formula was a nice formula of car. And the fact that Red Bull are still able to operate this car reliably and to do these sorts of events, I think shows how well engineered the cars were. And to take the car to the people for the first time who've not heard what a V8 at 18,000 RPM sounds like, or they haven't had that opportunity to smell what a Grand Prix car is like, I think is a responsibility. And it's one that I really enjoy because inside me is still the young boy that was fascinated to watch it on television. But of course, externally, there's the old man that's at a different phase of his life. But I think it helps keep me connected for my television work as well, because I think it's easy as an ex-driver to kind of forget that even though these cars are very well engineered, they are difficult to operate. They're not comfortable. You know, there's no air conditioning. There's no, you know, soft suspension. Even when I'm just doing these events, I always come out with bruises on my back or something, because it's a hostile.
Still physic.
It's physical in a different sense. It's very hot in the cockpit. There's no air conditioning, of course. So, you know, even though I'm just going up and down and going around in circles, you know, I'll still be sweating. And I have the same sense of pride at the end of it, knowing that we've put on a show, we've entertained people, and hopefully it's all been safe.
Form One is on a new great phase. After Drive to Survive, we're going to have, let's say, one of the best stages in the Form One history in terms of spectators, of fans. Do you think there is space to grow?
Yeah, I think there's still opportunity to grow the sport. And how would we measure that? Will it be measured in terms of global spectators? I guess it will be measured financially from a Liberty point of view as to what their revenues are. So that comes from broadcasters, as you know, and it comes from the actual promoters. And there's always a pressure on some of the say, more established racetracks. You know, I know from my involvement with Silverstone that there was times where it was very difficult for Silverstone to make the economics work. You know, we're not government funded. Mm-hmm. So we have to be able to run an operation where the revenues from the spectators are sufficient to pay, excuse me, the license fee. And also as a promoter, you don't have track signage to sell. You don't have, you know, other assets. You know, Formula One, once you sign the contract, they own the circuit effectively. They own the circuit signage. They own the television. When in your fan zones, the global partners for the beer suppliers or any other products that are consumer products, they have the priority out in the fan zone. So, you know, you're left with pretty much ticket sales as your source of income. But I think that Liberty, and I've got to say Chase Carey, really did a great job of understanding that these established non-government funded circuits need to be able to run a small profit or a break even. Otherwise, you're not running a business. And not many of the circuits that are not government funded have rich owners that are doing it just for the pleasure of hosting an event. You know, you need to be able to have a trading business.
We heard, I think last week, the guy from Hockenheim telling us about that. We don't have public funding, so it's difficult for us, Hockenheim. Germany doesn't have a race. It's odd with Mercedes and now Audi coming. Most of the races are still public funding, so it's difficult to have a Formula One race.
It is difficult, but that's, you know, entering Formula One is difficult. Anything that's really rewarding tends to be difficult. The easy things, then everyone can do that. So, of course, it's challenging. One, I think, thing just to add to that, I've heard that in Germany the television audience is declining. So despite the success that Mercedes have had, despite Michael Schumacher and then Vettel, and I guess Rosberg as a kind of half, you know, hybrid German, the audience is declining, which is worrying. And I guess maybe pay-per-view has meant that maybe Germans aren't as familiar with the concept of paying for broadcasting. Like in Britain, that's a very mature system. People are very happy to pay for if they're into football or if they're into motor racing. But I guess the question is, does Formula One need a race in Germany? If the answer is the numbers don't add up, then they probably don't right now. So it's worrying, I guess, for some of the old circuits, but business is business, and you've got to somehow, you've got to make it work.
Let's return to David Coulthard. I read once in an interview that you said that a winning car was sometimes a pain. Can you explain?
I don't remember that quote, but having a winning car, in my experience, a really fast car is more difficult to drive than an average car. Because if you imagine like the summit of Everest and it's a really windy day, it's more difficult to stand right on the top of the mountain than it is to be on one side where you're sheltered from the wind. And, you know, the peak of performance, all the cars have the same tires. So that Pirelli tire that's sitting here in your studio is being worked a lot harder on a Red Bull than it is on a Haas, because the Red Bull is extracting more lap time potential it's running higher G-force and therefore putting more load into the structure. Of course, the car has more downforce, which supports it. But you can see when you have a really good car, like Max is an exceptional driver, and he's taking more out of that car than Checo Perez. When Mercedes were at their peak, Lewis Hamilton was taking more out of the car more often than Nico did, even though Nico beat him in one of the seasons, and taking more out of the car than Valtteri. And when the car has dropped in performance a little bit, then you don't see much difference between Lewis and George. So what I've been saying is wait until the car is really good and then we can judge how good George is. I think George is very good, by the way, but you can't judge when they're kind of, the top end of the middle of the top 10. And you really only know when someone gets their big chance in a winning car how good they are, because the exceptional guys exploit that last little bit of performance.
Anyway, that's a good problem, because I don't see Max changing with Kevin.
Yeah, I don't think. Well, unless Max retires, which is always a potential, I don't see Red Bull saying, "Okay, we want Kevin in the car." Kevin's a very good driver.
No, I mean Max changing cars with.
Yeah, Kevin. No, I don't think he's going to go to Haas. No.
Nowadays. Some years ago, everybody was very young or starting Formula One very young. And now we have Fernando going to 42. We have Hamilton, Lewis going to 40. When you drove Formula One, where at age do you feel that you are at the peak as a driver?
Well, I think early 30s, sort of late 20s, early 30s, I felt personally was a peak time for me, because I had life experience, because I was quite a naive young village boy when I came to Formula One. And Formula One's this big, incredible world full of demands and opportunity. And it was completely alien to the life that I'd grown up with. And, if I'd grown up in a city like London, or, I was a more worldly individual, then maybe it wouldn't have been so challenging. But I had to learn on the job what it was like to be surrounded by lots of people, because I'd never been in that situation. A village of 350 people and a family in a motorhome going racing, it's a very different world. So I think that for me, late 20s, physically I was in great shape at that point. I really understood the physical preparation. Mentally, I'd found where I was fitting in life, because I didn't really know what people expected of me in my early 20s. And then once I got to my late 20s, early 30s, I was like, well, I don't really mind what people expect of me, because this is me. I started to feel comfortable in my own self, and my confidence grew as a man from that time. But I think that the drivers nowadays, and I even look at my 14-year-old son who's racing karts, he has a confidence at 14 that I didn't have at 24, because he's growing up in a different time, that we give the younger generation a voice. Mm. When I was growing up, and I suspect the same for you, I was a generation where children were seen and you were not to be heard. We were not invited into the adult conversation. So the world has changed, and I think that accelerates the development of the younger drivers. And they arrive in Formula One as teenagers, incredibly professional. They know how to work with the media. They know how to work with the engineers and simulators and all of that sort of thing. And I think that is a sort of general trend in life, that, sport has taught us that if you're good enough, you're old enough. And it doesn't matter if you're a 17-year-old footballer or 17-year-old tennis player. If you win the major tournament, you've done it because you're talented. But in business, historically, we didn't give teenagers an opportunity, because it was like, oh no, you have to join the company as an apprentice and spend the next 10 years even being recognized before you get a proper salary. That's all gone nowadays. You've got multimillionaire teenagers with online businesses and things like that. So I think we just have to accept that your Max generation can do it from a young age. And your phenomenal drivers like Lewis and Fernando can still do it at an older age, when historically, normally, sports people are retired.
But that closes more the Formula One doors to more young drivers, because the nowadays drivers keep more time in Formula One. It's more difficult to reach Formula One.
You're right, it is more difficult. But I know one thing as a fact. When the next phenomenon comes through, Formula 3 and Formula 2, Formula 1 will find a space for them. Because that's what happens. You know, Max came in, he didn't do Formula 2. He went straight to Formula 1 because it was clear the guy was exceptional. I remember Lewis, Kimi, straight from Formula 3. You know, he did his first test around Mugello. Mugello is one of the scariest racetracks you'll drive in a Formula 1 car. He went straight from Formula Renault or something to driving a Formula 1, and he was quick. Incredible. That proves an unbelievable talent. So Formula 1, like any pinnacle of any sport, is not about just giving all the young people a chance. It's about finding the exceptional talents that come in and beat the big champions. And in every sport it happens. There's always a young pretender that comes in and beats the Federer or beats the Ronaldos or whoever it happens to be. You know, you have your chance and you have your time. Life isn't fair, full stop. So not every great talent gains the opportunity, but exceptionals, they very rarely are unmissed.
From your side, your beginning in Formula One was very far from a nice way to begin a career in Formula One.
Yeah, tragic, horrible, crazy weekend in Imola. We lost Roland Ratzenberger, as you know, on the Saturday, Ayrton on the Sunday. And I remember I was racing at Silverstone in Formula 3000, which was effectively Formula 2 today. And I remember watching on the television, because our race at Silverstone was on the Monday. So Sunday was qualifying day, and seeing the crash and, like everybody, seeing a little bit of movement from Ayrton and thinking it's going to be okay. And then later that day, we all got the terrible news that, you know, unbelievably, we'd lost two drivers in one weekend. So horrible scenario for the sport, for the fans of the sport, and for Williams. And the way Frank Williams led the team was very in keeping with the way he came back from his own injury, where he's paralyzed, he's a quadriplegic, and he was able to come back into the sport, surviving that accident, and lead the team to be world champions again. And his approach of racing with only Damon Hill in Monaco, which normally Formula One would never allow, you only enter one car, but I think everybody understood, you know, Bernie Ecclestone and Max Mosley, that this was a you know, unique set of circumstances. And this, you know, Ayrton was many ways this sport. He was the most revered driver of that time. And then 3 weeks later, I'm driving in Barcelona and making my debut. So I was completely unequipped in terms of being able to understand what that meant from a media point of view. So I had to rely on the Williams team, press team, to help me understand, how do you answer the questions? But I think that because the whole world was shocked with what happened, actually the media of that time were incredibly respectful of giving me the space to just get in the car and make my debut. So today, I'm not sure, I'm not being disrespectful, but the media has changed, hasn't it? The landscape of media has changed, and I think it would be a lot more controversial the way things would be reported today, more black and white. And I think that there was an element of allow people space to recover from that traumatic experience.
But how was it for you in terms of the things on track? Because you don't have a second chance for causing a good first impression.
First impression, yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. I'd driven for Williams as test driver for 3 years, so I knew the team very well. I didn't actually know that car, because I'd only done one lap in the car pre-season.
It was difficult to drive that car.
It was difficult to drive, because the Formula One had gone from active from cars in 93 into passive. So I'd been part of the development of the Williams going, and when we first drove the passive, it was so aggressive, you know, it was being like
stiff.
Shaken. Yeah,
stiff.
Very stiff, yeah. The active cars were like magic carpets. They floated around the racetrack. So it was a challenging car to drive. And as I say, pre-season in Jerez in Spain, I was at the test and Ayrton flew in from Brazil overnight and his flight was a bit delayed. So I was put in the car to shake the car down just to check the car was operationally good. And then I was testing the 93B car, which was the passive car. The first three Grand Prix, as you know, Ayrton was in pole position, but didn't finish any of those races, yeah. Tragically, with his death in the third race in Imola. But such was his talent, he put the car on pole position for each of those races. But the first time I actually drove the car in for more than one lap was in the Barcelona weekend. And in that particular weekend, there was a controversy on the Friday, and a number of teams boycotted Friday free practice, including Williams. So the first time I actually drove the car for more than one lap was in qualifying on Friday. So quite a difficult debut learning the car when you've got four runs. I don't remember where I qualified. It was inside the top 10, but maybe like fifth or sixth. And then in the race, I was running, I think I gained a couple of places and then the gearbox broke. So I never finished the first Grand Prix. And then the next race was Canada and I finished in the points. So, but it was a pretty difficult debut because I just didn't have any experience of that car.
On that year, first podium in Estoril.
Yeah.
Was to be a win?
Well, I was leading ahead of Damon, but because he was battling in the championship, then the team, of course, asked me to move over. And he overtook me at the chicane and I finished second.
You get the revenge, let's say.
Yes, the year after.
The year after.
Yeah, I'm very proud of, and normally I think I don't talk too much about my time in Formula One in a confident or arrogant way. But I have to say, I'm very proud of that first win because I had pole position, fastest lap, and I won the race doing three stops when Michael was doing two. And I had Michael and Damon beside me on the podium. So to beat your teammate is always important, but to have Michael beside me, because he was an established champion already, then I really felt that was a moment to say, look, I can compete at the highest level.
If you have to choose a win in Formula One, still is Magny-Cours, the bird race?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, because, and I know it may be slightly confusing to people who don't really, haven't followed Formula One for a long time, but That race was just so, I had so much frustration, if you like. Michael was a hard racer and I totally respect his championships, but sometimes he went beyond what I consider to be sporting. That's my opinion. I'm entitled to it. Other people may disagree and I respect that. But on that race, I qualified second to Michael. It was a very fraught qualifying because we had a problem with my car, and I went to the test, the T car, and then Mika had a problem with his car.
You got the Mika car.
And then I ended up going to Mika's car. So I qualified second to Schumacher in Mika's car, and then I went back to my car for the race, got chopped by Michael at the first corner, Rubens overtook me, and then I'm third. And I had to come back and overtake and fight to win the race. So I think that's why I felt so strongly that was a strong victory, because, you know, I had to overtake two Ferraris, and overtaking one is difficult enough. But it was a good day.
We have done an interview about 30 years ago. At the time,
I'm not that old. Okay, I am that old. Yeah.
You were at Formula 3000 fighting with Pedro Lamy and Oliver Panis for the Formula 3000 title in 93. And I recall that at one time, talking about preparation, physical preparation, you told me you don't run. It's incredible how a Formula 1 driver can prepare himself not running. Running is part of preparation.
Well, yes, normally, but I had a crash in 1990 in Belgium at the, it was actually the Grand Prix weekend, and Opel Lotus, which Pedro was also racing, was the support race. And anyway, first lap, crash. And I was incredibly lucky because the Opel Lotus car was made out of aluminium, and another car's gearbox crashed into the side of my car. And my legs ended up on top of each other because the car was completely crushed and it broke the bone close to my knee and my right leg. And back in those days, you know, you didn't do keyhole surgery. You just had a plaster cast, and then I wanted to get back in the car. I missed one race, and then so I think I was out for 3 weeks, and I was back in the car because I figured with a soft cast, as long as I could jump on one leg for the medical yeah. officer, and if I could show that I could jump on one leg, then they would let me drive the car. So of course I made sure I took plenty of painkillers and maybe had a small injection just to take away the pain. I did the jump, and then I was able to go racing again. But after that, whenever I ran, I just got a rubbing against the tendon. So I started to cycle and swim and rowing. The rowing is a great exercise because it's a horrible exercise. you there's nowhere to hide on a rowing machine. You just have to mentally crank out the time, and you're working your arms, you're working your back, you're working your legs, you're doing cardio yeah. you're working your brain, because actually on a bicycle sometimes you can, you know, feel good with the fresh air running through your hair and looking at the pretty scenery. Running, you can adjust a little bit how you're doing the run to find comfort. But on the rowing machine, it's mentally tough to sit on a rowing machine for an hour. So I think actually helped not being able to run, because it forced me to have to do more painful forms of exercise.
Coming back for this time, this we were speaking about the new guys seeing Formula One because of Driving to Survive. Is the new audiences? It's good, but it's not so loyal audiences. So it's Formula One is to take care of these audiences. Don't you think the domination from a season like this is a bit dangerous for these new audiences?
Well, thankfully,
they are some kind volatile.
Yeah, I hear you, but thankfully the new audience are all big fans of drinking Red Bull, so they're happy that Max is winning most of the races. No, I understand what you're saying. Drive to Survive, COVID, people at home, was out of a horrible situation, became a big catalyst for engaging with a new audience for Formula One. And again, credit to Sean Bratches and to Liberty for signing this the series that allowed access to Formula One that had never been given before. The first season, I think Red Bull and Ferrari or Red Bull and Mercedes didn't allow the cameras mm-hmm. to be there because they're like, well, hold on, we're giving away value. What are we getting out of it? And then, of course, after season one, everyone went, ah.
They understood.
We understand. Yeah. This is really important in America. So fantastic vision from Liberty and City of Sean Bratches and Chase Carey, who were running Formula One at that time. And I would rather have new audience that you might lose a few than old audience that you definitely will lose some through natural aging.
Aging.
So I don't think you should fear growth, even if it might be transitional, it might be short term, because it's like climbing a mountain. You might get only slowly up the cliff face, but once you've got a hold, that becomes the benchmark. That becomes where you build from. And America's still a big potential, a big growth. You know, it's the size of Europe, and we've only just scratched the surface. And we've got 3 Grand Prix there by the end of the year, by the time we get to Vegas. I guess traditionalists will be concerned that Formula One is going more and more outside of Europe. But Formula One's a business like any business. And if you don't grow, then the chances are a competitor is going to come along and overtake you. So it's natural in this world that we have to seek new territories.
We have here David Coulter, the ex-Formula One driver. David Coulter, the fan of motor racing, the TV pundit, the TV producer. Mm-hmm. What do you think about bringing more teams to Formula One and the 25 Grand Prix?
So 25 Grand Prix, if you actually balance it out with the era that I started, we had 15 Grand Prix. But we did more than 15 Grand Prix in testing because we were always testing in Estoril or Barcelona or Jerez. So we had a separate test team. And so after every Grand Prix, we would then go somewhere and test for 3 days and do three Grand Prix in between the next Grand Prix. So I've lived through the generation as a driver where we had that level of physical demand, but we had none of the financial reward that the drivers get today because the sport was just a little bit smaller. Now, the drivers are more than capable of doing 25 Grand Prix. When you think about it, it's 50 hours if all the races went 2 hours, which they don't. 50 hours a year of work in terms of the Grand Prix, they can do it and no one's going to feel sorry for them.
What about the teams?
The challenge is the teams, the mechanics, the engineers, the support crews, the catering staff, who I think are the hardest working people in Formula One because they're there before the team and they're last to leave. Modern Formula One is regulated where there's curfews and the mechanics cannot be at the track all night. And again, in my generation, and that means in Lewis's generation and Fernando's generation, because they were both starting before I finished, there was a much bigger, let's say, hourly demand on the mechanics and engineers. So is it physically possible? Yes. Is it logistically tough because of the nature of Formula One? It is, but I think that we can all agree there can be a better calendar in terms of when you're in the Middle East, stay in the Middle East. When we're in America, stay in America and do South America, Brazil, Mexico.
A zone calendar.
Yeah, a zone calendar, which would just, I think we'll end up going that direction just from a point of view of everyone's target of reducing emissions and also just the demands on the time for the people involved. And remember, everyone who works in Formula One, it's not a sentence that's been given to them by a court. It's a choice. Anyone doesn't like the demands, then they're welcome to go and work somewhere else, to be blunt about it. So
that is happening right now.
A lot of people are stepping away, absolutely. But as sure as they step away, someone else will come forward. Because there's a young, curious mechanic that wants to travel the world. There's an engineer that wants that challenge. And if it means that those guys have a shorter career, then you could argue that what we were saying about being bad for the drivers because they stay longer, maybe it's good for the engineers and mechanics, the turnover, because they stay shorter. And then they go off and take those skills they've learned in Formula One into other forms of motor racing or other business.
We need or we don't need more teams.
The team question is it comes down to this. If you're Ferrari, Red Bull, Mercedes, and you've invested billions to win a proportion of the revenue that comes back from the commercial rights, what they're obviously saying is, well, hold on, if David Coulthard starts a Formula One team, let's say I raise 200 million to start a team. I buy the engines from Honda, I buy the gearbox from Red Bull, I buy everything like Haas. I have to build the chassis. I've done that. And I'm at the back of the grid, but I get this, a large percentage of the revenue. I could very quickly have a business model where I'm not really there competing to try and win. I'm just there because I can get a percentage of that billion.
You have a profit.
You could run a little profitable team, but with no desire, and you haven't done the years of all the investment. So I do think, in the same way, Ferrari get paid more than Mercedes and Red Bull, because they are what's called a legacy payment, because they've been there since 1950. They've been there since the very beginning. That seems fair to me. You know, if I start a team, do I honestly believe I deserve the same amount of the percentage as Ferrari, who've invested for 60 years? Who built a brand around it. Yeah. So I think what's happening is, so if the question, would it be good to have more cars on the grid? Absolutely. Why not? It gives more potential for entertainment. But a bit like when we had Caterham and we had Marussia, they were never seriously ever competing towards the front. So did we ever truly believe they were ever going to be anything more than at the back? I want everyone to be successful in life. You know, I would love this utopian world where everyone achieves their dreams. But meanwhile, back in the real world, normally people who work hard and you know have vision normally win through in the end. So, you know, Formula One is difficult. And I think there's a middle ground, and it's like everything, it's a negotiation. There'll be a middle ground between commercial rights holder, the current 10 teams, and who that new team might be and how they might structure, you know, how they get a share of the pie. Because, you know, we're three of us sitting here in the studio talking. Let's say we're sharing 100 between us, and then somebody else comes in that hasn't put the years in that we have, you know, to be able to sit here, and they expect the same. We might go, well, hold on a minute, we've been doing this for 30 years. Really, do you think you deserve the same? And they go, yes, because I'm part of the show. We might say, well, look, at the moment, we'll not give you 25%. How about we give you 20%? And if you keep going for the next 10 years, we'll give you that extra 5%. That would seem very generous, no?
Yep.
So that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with what's fair if somebody comes in.
David, we are near the end. Let's put the last question like this. You are not a driver. You are not a TV producer, TV commentator, part of the Formula One world. What is the reason to go and sit in front of a television, a TV screen, whatever, to see a Formula One race?
For me or yeah, for a spectator?
You. No, for you.
I love the buzz before the start of a Grand Prix. I love the uncertainty. It doesn't matter who you are. You've got no idea what's going to happen at the first corner. You cannot predict what's about to happen. And I love the fact that the people that are drawn to this sport are high achievers. It doesn't matter, as I said, whether it's the catering team or the engineering or the drivers. It's hard to get there. And money can certainly help some drivers get into Formula One, but with super license and things like that, you've got to have earned some success to enter. And I just think that being around high achieving, motivated, hardworking people is a very exciting place to live, because everyday life is a little bit disappointing. You know, people don't do what they say they're going to do. They don't turn up on time. They promise they'll do something and they don't do it. No one survives in Formula One if they don't turn up on time. First race of the season, all the cars are on the grid. Ever seen a driver not turn up because he slept in? No, they're there on time. It's so important to everyone that works in this sport to do their job. That's addictive. And even only doing television, we want to do it to the best of our ability. We want to do it because we share our points of view with people that don't have the access to being at the track and don't get to meet the drivers and don't get to see the cars and the engineering. And, you know, we can share our insight and our ability to touch it with people that in the future might be presenters and commentators, or in the future they might be engineers or drivers. And there needs to be an influence to get people interested. And so I was influenced by Murray Walker and James Hunt, supported by my mother and father. And today, maybe I'm influencing some young boy and girl that goes, ah, okay, that sounds fun. And maybe in the future, they'll come to me and say, ah, you know, I listened to you when I was a kid and I thought you were talking absolute bollocks, but I wanted to come and see this sport because it sounded exciting.
But the question now is, how do you motivate this year people to keep watching the races when everybody says, oh, I know who is going to win?
Yeah, because nobody knows who's going to win. You of course.
No, especially this year.
No. Yeah. You know, yes, there's a high degree of certainty with modern Formula One. The cars are so reliable. The fastest car qualifies at the front. And if there's no safety cars or bad weather, then it becomes a lot more predictable, of course. But no one in the history of the sport has won all the races. No driver or no team. It came close in 88 with McLaren. They won 15 out of 16 races. Red Bull maybe will be the first team to do that. But I'd be surprised if that's the case, because...
But that is a fact also. And that will make a headline also. If they win all the races.
Yeah. when Mercedes were dominant, Red Bull admired what they were doing, Ferrari admired what they were doing, all the teams admired because they know how difficult it is. It's now the turn of Red Bull, and Mercedes have a target, Ferrari have a target, because what Red Bull have achieved is what is legally achievable within the regulations. So the others can do it as well, because their quality, just because McLaren aren't winning races, they're still a brilliant team of people, you know, brilliant men and women who, for whatever reason, have missed the target. They're not 15 seconds off the pace. They're 2-3 tenths off the pace. An incredibly small margin around a 5-6 kilometer racetrack. As we know, it's a big gap in racing terms, but in engineering terms, it's tiny. And therefore, they're all within one more step of equaling what Red Bull are doing. In the same way that when it was Mercedes, Red Bull and Ferrari, and they were all just one step away. And the new regulations, normally when you have a big regulation change, it shakes up the running order. Mm-hmm. History has shown that. This time, Red Bull have exploited these new regulations, but that gap will close, and at some point, someone will beat them. Not because they're no longer good, it's because this sport doesn't stand still. Next weekend in Austria, there'll be upgrades on the car for all the teams. Doesn't mean they'll all be better. Someone might take a bigger step forward. So yeah, that to me is what makes it exciting. And you know, it doesn't, I don't win Grand Prix anymore. I don't lose Grand Prix anymore. Largely speaking, it doesn't matter to me who wins or loses. I want to see a good battle, and it doesn't necessarily mean at the front, in the middle. I want to see these drivers doing things that people go, wow, how did they do that?
David, thank you very much for your time. Espero que tenham gostado desta entrevista, deste podcast especial com o David Coulthard. Nós voltaremos com mais podcasts aqui na Sport TV, o F1 na Sport TV e também o Grelha de Partida. Até lá.